right. Okay. That's funny. Last day. Everybody got their toothpicks ready? A couple of us went out to hold your eyelids open. Janice is looking at me like I'm nuts. Toothpicks ready? A couple of us went out to eat at Wendy's, and I made the comment. I said, you know, at Wendy's, when I eat at Wendy's, I have my biggest problem isn't figuring out what to eat. It's whether to have a soda or a Frosty. And I decided I'd take the soda because I might need the caffeine more than I needed the ice cream. So I'm all caffeined up. Anybody else? Ready to go? Good. Here we go. Maybe. There it is. We have been, all week we've been talking about the future of the church, how the church is going to survive. We've looked at three different components of that so far. We've looked at protecting the next generation, taking the youth that we have in our congregations from very small clear up, even though I spent quite a bit of time talking about teens, but it really applies to all age groups. Next generation, somebody pointed this out to me, next generation, I guess, is just like conservative and liberal. It depends on your perspective. So I'll let you decide what the next generation consists of. But bringing them up, encouraging them. We talked about teaching, keeping, and restoring those that are already in the church. Last couple of days, we've spent some time talking about convicting the non-believer, how to talk to those that are outside the church, some attitudes or thoughts or beliefs that you might encounter on a regular basis. And today we're going to talk about what can happen within the church. The process of the people of God turning away from Him. How does that happen? What happens? What does it look like? Is there ways we can see it so we can stop it before it happens? We're going to talk about some of those. But before we get into those things that are listed on your outline, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the state of the Bible in America. There is a group called the American Bible Society, and they do a lot of different things, but the only thing I really care about too much that they do the most is every year they take a nationwide survey of Americans. And they take this survey and they ask questions and get responses, and they try to evaluate what the state of the Bible is in the United States of America. How is it thought of? How is it treated? What does it do? How do people react to it? Okay? Now, if you want this, I have the whole thing on my computer. It's a 32-page PDF file full of the questions that they ask, the statistics that they got, all the percentages, and it's got graphs. If you like numbers, it's kind of an interesting piece of work. If you don't like sorting through statistics and numbers, you don't want it. You can find it online, too. That's where I found it. Okay, I got it online. But I do have it on my computer as a PDF file. If you want it, you've got a flash drive. I've taken over Mark's technology class for a second. If you have something you want, I'll let you download it on there. It's no problem. Okay? But I want to talk, I'm not talking about the whole thing, so don't worry too much, but I do want to point out a few things. They found that there is an average of 4.3 Bibles per household in the United States of America. That's pretty good. Now, I really don't know. I couldn't tell from the way they worded things. I couldn't tell if that included things like Bibles on your computer or your phone or your iPad, or if it was just physical books. I really don't know. But whichever it is, if it's just physical books, if they count all the electronic stuff, that number's a lot bigger probably. But the United States averages 4.3 Bibles per household. Is that pretty good? What does that say? What would that say initially to you about the Bible in America? I got a whole lot of things all at once. Somebody down in here said something. It was, you would think people would be reading it. It's available.
People value it.
There's some value there because they have them. You know. Now, there's a really good question at this point in our society. How many of those Bibles were purchased by the people that live in that household, and how many of them are heirlooms that have been handed down for 8 generations and they just didn't feel like they could throw the Bible away? You know, who knows? But then there was this statistic. 47% believe the Bible has too little influence in our society. Almost half. So now you have 4.3 Bibles per household. You have 47% of people believe that the Bible has too little influence on society. How do you make the Bible have more influence in society? Yeah.
Or you flip it over and say, you know, the other 53% thinks it has too much.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be 53% because there was also the I don't know.
Yeah, I'd like to see the rest of that. I'm surprised that percentage isn't higher.
Higher? Yeah. Now you're looking from perspective two. What's a godly country? I don't know. Because of this, this next statistic applies directly to what we're just about to talk about. 46% say they read the Bible only once or twice a year. Okay, so we live in a society where there's lots of Bibles available. Lots of people, all realistically, compared to other countries, lots of people feel like the Bible should have more influence on society than it does. Nobody's reading it.
And by read, that means just look at it and read it a little bit.
That's what I'm assuming. They would all be reading. That was the smallest category they had. Once or twice a year, and then it was like once or twice a month or once or twice a week. If I remember right. I didn't print that all off, so I don't have that in front of me, but that's what I'm remembering.
This may mean we're not doing our homework.
Now, that's kind of cruel self-reflection, isn't it? Are we promoting reading the Bible like we should? Isn't that song true? This is showing us that. Remember, we talked about when you're trying to convict the non-believer, a lot of times, well, every time, you need a relationship with that person. And what's the point of that relationship? To show them the love of God and what a Christian is supposed to be, as well as tell them. 69% believe that the Bible provides answers. Now, this question was not specific to religious or moral answers. It was just answers and advice on how to live a better life. That was the way the question was phrased. It was just about a better life. So I can see a lot of people that answered that this way just thinking, well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that will help me get along with my neighbor or help me have a better relationship with my wife or something like that. Not necessarily the answers on how to get into heaven, which is what we would think of, is my point. 79% believed they were knowledgeable about the Bible. Now remember how many people were reading it on a regular basis? Now I'm gonna do this quiz with you too up here. I did it with the kids downstairs. Help me out because I might forget. Let's name the first 5 books of the Bible. You ready? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. 54% of people were unable to do that on the question. Some of them, of these 54%, some just didn't even try because they couldn't. They had no clue. Some were able to get a couple of them, or three, but not very many. Some of them put the wrong book in there. There was quite a number. I forget the percentage now. I should have tried to write that down and remember that. But there was quite a number of them that had Joshua as one of the first five books. I perceive that perhaps some of them just started naming books that they thought might be somewhere in the beginning somewhere. So when you go out to talk to the non-believer, or even people that have been in churches of various flavors all of their life or a good portion of their life, there's a real good chance that they don't read the Bible on a regular basis, and they think they know a lot about the Bible, but they really don't. Now this is a statement that was on this survey, okay? And people were supposed to respond to it. I strongly agree. I somewhat agree. I somewhat disagree. I strongly disagree. I have no opinion. Okay? Those were the options. The Bible, Quran, and Book of Mormon are all different expressions of the same spiritual truth. That was a statement that the people were supposed to respond to. Remember, it was agree, either strongly or somewhat, disagree strongly or somewhat, or I don't have opinion. That was their five options. 46% agreed strongly or somewhat. Remember, I was talking about the different kinds of skeptics, and there was several in there that would take pieces from different religions, or they believed that all religions were the same, or they believed that all religions taught the same basic truth. That's these people, 46% of them. Now, this is what I thought was interesting, too. 46% disagreed strongly or somewhat. It's the exactly same amount. We live in a split society over these documents. We really do. It's basically 50-50. It's basically 50-50. Now the other 8%, right? 8%? Yeah. The other 8% were all the, I don't have an opinion. And you know, that I don't have an opinion could come from, I don't think I know enough about them to respond to this question, or I don't care. So what does... Tell me what you see. What does this tell us? And there's a lot of other things in there, but what do some of these things, these I think were the most important for our discussions in this class, what does this tell us about people in the United States and the Bible? What are some conclusions? Most of them, even though they may think they are biblically illiterate. They just don't know. But they don't know that they don't know.
When I left GM in 2008, there was only one gentleman that I worked with who had any regular knowledge of the Bible. And I would lunch together and discuss the issue. But since about 2005, it has been illegal in GM for a manager to have a copy of the Bible on his desk, because it's promoting something that General Orders did not want promoted, any kind of religion.
Mm-hmm.
So the ACLU and organizations like that are not helping the situation.
No. They are making it more difficult for us to share the gospel in the workplace, to share the gospel in public ways like that. Especially, if I understand it right, especially from supervisor to underlings is the word I wanted to use, but that's not very nice.
Subordinates.
Subordinates, thank you. I needed somebody in the corporate world to help me with that phrase. I don't have any opinion. That's what they said. And there could have been a multitude of reasons why that it didn't ask. But the other 8%, and I don't remember what the breakdown was between strongly and somewhat. Those were broke apart on the actual survey, and I just added them together for ease of talking about it. And I don't remember how they were broke down.
Do you have any idea of what part of the United States this is?
So they claim that they make phone calls to all states and they try to use the population maps to try to concentrate and hit areas. So what does that tell us? It's a possibility they got a whole lot of answers from, sorry, but L.A. and New York and Florida, highly populated areas, and not too many from Missouri and Kansas and Iowa, where this survey might be a lot different. Yeah. And that's a very good point.
But you have to look very closely at how they ran the survey.
And I don't remember that part from it. It's been too long since I looked at it.
Doug, I had a friend that she was in her probably 30s, and her husband got a illness that ended up taking his life. But you know, she started
Yeah. By many of the young people, it's considered a dated book. Yep. I know from my experience, having spent some time working in a facility with teenagers that are dealing with all kinds of issues from all over the U.S., we would sit down to have our studies, and one of the first things I would do was give them a Bible. And for the majority of those kids, it was the first Bible they'd ever actually touched with their hands. Many of them would say, I've never held a Bible before, let alone, you know, read or tried to find. All they knew about it was what they'd heard from somebody. Well, this to me... Oh, go ahead.
Have you seen this survey in the past year to develop a trend?
I looked back a couple of years. I didn't go back much further than that. But as recent as 2 years ago, that first... make sure. This statistic right here... I'm sorry, I'm pointing at my computer screen, which doesn't help you. 46% and 46%. As close as 3 to 4 years ago, from what I could tell, the percentage that disagreed with that statement was higher, and the percentage that agreed with that statement was lower. So that has leveled off, balanced off. That's the one that I remember about the trends, how it's differed. Because that one was, at the time I was really interested, when I was looking at this, I was really interested in that statistic. So that part I looked. And that has leveled off in the past few years. And look at our society. We're, as a society, our society is becoming more and more accepting of what we would call these radical points of view, either radical Christianity or radical other faith, whatever it is.
The 2010 census was really alarming on the family values, really taking a hit. This extreme, the trend is really getting much sharper.
Yeah.
For same-sex families. And
right. For all the immoral things that people want to think is okay that we take stands on, that's just becoming more and more acceptable.
I think the 70-90% there that believe they are knowledgeable about the Bible, in my experience, you know, when you're talking to somebody that's very religious, living in that church, you know, are involved in all the activities of their church or whatever, their denominational group, and you just start talking to them about things that we teach our children, you know, Noah, Moses, mm-hmm. You know, they have not a clue. They don't know what you're talking about. So it makes you really start to think, wait a minute, I need to back up. These people really don't know anything about the Bible, and I can't talk to them like they do. The other thing is, from the pulpit, so many times we hear preachers say, we all know the story of whoever, Joshua.
I do that. I'm guilty of that myself.
And probably we don't fall.
Yeah, there may not be. Yep.
I think one of the best examples of this is the game Jeopardy on TV.
I was actually thinking of that.
They'll bring up Bible questions that my kids could knock out and have been able to do that for years. And these really, quote-unquote, smart people on the show.
And they leave that section alone until the very end. I'm gonna do that last, so maybe I don't have to make it through all those questions. Yeah.
Many of you know that the state of California has had a series of ballot measures over the years about gay marriage and gay rights, and always, or for a long time, these measures were defeated, and particularly on same-sex marriage. But the vote is getting closer and closer and closer to being able to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to National Public Radio a while back, and basically the statement of the advocates for that was that we just have to wait for the older people to die off.
Yep.
Because it's the younger generation that is more accepting. I think that points out the need to really teach our children
right.
to not only read the scriptures, but to memorize the scriptures. And that's another thing that I see. Personally, in churches I've been involved with that is really, really falling off. We must memorize a lot of scriptures when we were kids, but it's not being done now. I would like to see us really concentrating more and more on reading it and memorization of scripture in our home congregations and within our families.
When we're relating to our religious neighbors who go to Christian churches, we have to understand that religion has contributed a lot to this. There are lots of churches that are supposedly Christian that have taught we don't need to study the Old Testament, and you're really can basically do whatever you want in the church as long as you think it's all right.
You need Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Revelation. That's really all you need to talk about.
Yeah. I was talking to one one-time member of one of those churches, and she was very sure that they were following the Bible. I said, do you actually study the Bible? She was indignant. I said, she said, well, yes, we do. And she mentioned the Sunday school literature they got and a daily devotional thing she got. She was being honest.
Mm-hmm.
She really couldn't say that they studied the Bible. She didn't admit that, but that's the way most churches are. They don't really study the Bible.
Yeah.
They turn aside the
tables. We're just going to do a couple more. I saw, okay, over here.
I have three grandchildren. They serve in a different in both church. And I asked them, when they asked them, what story did you have today? And they said, well, we spent half the time doing art and the other half doing cooking.
Yeah.
Didn't have a Bible study story? No, they do that upstairs.
Yeah, not usually. Yeah.
This is bigger kids, too.
In regards to the 79%, unfortunately, many of the so-called mainline Christian churches are now okay with homosexuality, marriages, clergy. Many of them believe that Jesus was okay with same-sex marriages and homosexuality. That's being taught in the public.
Yeah.
And many of these churches too are related to the gospel for salvation, but there is the human civil rights movement rather than salvation.
That's right.
It's pretty sad.
Okay, we're going to get one more, and then we're going to move on.
Well, I don't want to debunk the point you're trying to make, but it's easy for us to kind of make fun of people's size of the church. But Dave Evans did a survey over a period of months of church members and used the information in a different game of lead. And I wasn't there, but it seemed like wasn't one of the questions like name four apostles or something? It was like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah. We have to make sure that we're knowledgeable. That's part of it. And actually, that leads me right into my first point. Because as we talk about what happens, at least what I see, what could happen as God's people start to move away from Him, I think the first thing that happens is apathy. Now, it may not be the first thing. I have these five things on your outline, and I don't want to say one happens and then the next and then the next, because I don't know that that's always true. And I don't want to say that one is more damaging than any of the others. It's just the order I put them in. But the first thing I want to talk about is apathy. And it very well may be the first thing. After I said all that, I think it's possible. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because Mark Herman did a really good job on Sunday talking about this. And if you weren't here, go online and listen, because it was good. It's very good. And I just have a couple of verses that I want to bring up. One is Matthew 15:9. In vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. And I want to focus on the in vain they worship me part. One of the ways I think our worship can become vain or worthless or pointless is when we're just not in it. We're there, but we're not there. We're thinking about other things. We're wondering about other things. We're so dissatisfied that we just can't get involved emotionally or mentally. And then I also wanted to bring up John 4:23-24, when Jesus is talking with the woman at the well. He says, eventually it's going to come a point where my people are going to worship me how? In spirit and in truth. So the truth is pretty important. We talked, you know, Rick spoke to that. I've spoke to that. Others have spoke to that. The truth is pretty important, but we can't forget about the spirit part. There's got to be a want to in our worship and in our study of the Bible. And I think one of the things that that survey showed me is that within the United States, there is a little bit of apathy. At least we could see from that in regard to acknowledgement or confidence or valuing the Word of God. And I would hope that that doesn't bleed over into the church too much, but I'm afraid it does from time to time. I think another thing that can happen that can be a sign that God's people are starting to wander from Him is that the commands of God begin to be watered down. They just don't hold the punch that they used to, because we've not changed them completely, just a little. But how much is too much? When is watered down? I don't know. When is lemonade really good and when is it kind of nasty? Because it's too watery. I don't know where that line is. But we have to be very, very careful. I think this started in Genesis chapter 3. God told them a command. What was the command? What was the one rule they had? Don't eat that tree. There were no qualifying statements, no accepts, no nothing. Don't eat of that tree. And when Satan came to Eve and questioned her, his eventual statement was, "You will not surely die." And then he began to explain how they would know things they didn't know before and they could be like God. And God didn't want anybody to be as smart as he was. He started watering it down right there immediately. He added some things to it that made it not pure anymore. Not complete. And it got watered down. I'll take you back again to Matthew 15:9. Only the second half this time. The idea of teaching as commandments, or teaching as doctrines, the commandments of men. Teaching as doctrines, the commandments of men. We have to be real careful that when we're teaching what the Word of God says, that we're teaching what the Word of God says and not what we wish the Word of God said. Or not what our congregation has done ever since my great-great-grandpappy was a little boy and pretending that that's the same as God saying it. Because, to be honest, that's what happened in the apostasy at the very beginning, wasn't it? And it's what is happening in churches all over the U.S. They're not studying this anymore. They're studying what somebody thought. And that's dangerous. I didn't pause after apathy because it's been covered pretty well, but I will pause here if there's any comments or thoughts on the idea of watering down the commandments of God.
Now, this is one of the reasons we don't have a written creed.
Yeah.
Because a written creed is a simplified thing that you can get a lot of people to agree to, but the problem is that they won't really know the Bible. They won't know, even if the things in the creed are pretty scriptural, they won't know why.
Yeah.
We need to study the Word. To go on to what Dean said, it is a problem we have too. One congregation I was at one time, they had a class for adults and they were studying a religious book other than the Bible. And I asked why they did that, and they thought, well, the Bible's kind of intimidating to people, and they thought that this was kind of, somehow this would get people interested in the Bible. I felt pretty bad because it's more like we're ashamed of the Bible.
Maybe they needed to be intimidated a little bit.
Yeah.
When you read Romex's book or any other history, you realize that everybody that has moved away from what we consider the scriptural normally did it in very tiny steps.
Mm-hmm.
That they thought they were improving the bad by not studying the Bible and doing it just a little bit better than they thought.
Just a little.
They have moved off in a direction, and I don't think anybody was trying to do that, but that's where they ended up. Step by step, they have moved away from the Word.
And eventually you end up with people that know they're not doing what's there, but don't care because it's been taught and evidently it must be right.
He was a really sweet old man and we wanted him to be baptized before he died, so we did it on his deathbed.
Right. That's right. Okay, let's go to the next one. Mixing of evil with good. This, I think, is another kind of signifier that something's amiss. We're headed down the wrong path. We're going in the wrong direction. If things that are evil begin to be crossed or mixed with things that are good. The passage in Luke 16:13. No servant can serve two masters. When I read that, no servant can serve two masters, I don't think he's saying it's not a good idea. I think he's saying it's impossible. It can't be done. The reason I think he's saying that is because of Genesis 1:4. In Genesis 1:4, God's beginning the process of creating the world. It's all dark, so he creates light. And in Genesis 1:4, what does he say? What does it say that God did with that light and the dark? He separated it. He separated it. Now, an example I like to use is if I have a aquarium up here and it's a nice freshwater aquarium and I've got it all set up for freshwater fish, I put freshwater fish in there. Can I take a canister of Morton salt and pour it in one corner and then put saltwater fish on that side? Why not? Yeah, it's like a smoking section. Okay. Yeah, I'm not a biologist and I don't pretend to be. The comment was, please don't use Morton salt for your saltwater fish. I don't know what salt you're supposed to use, but apparently that's wrong. Which that would emphasize my point a little more. What you're going to end up with is not saltwater fish over here and freshwater fish over here. You're going to end up with a lot of happy saltwater fish because they've got extra room because all the others are dead. Because that salt is going to diffuse through the whole system, through that whole tank. A little leaven. That's the watering down of God's commands. But this, I think, is God showing us, what do you get when you mix light with dark? You get light. Because you can't, there isn't anything in between. I mean, sure, okay, we have shades of gray. Yeah. Whatever. But God says there's light and there's dark, and the two don't mix. And so in John, he said, the light came into the world, and the darkness couldn't overcome it. Doesn't know what to do with it. Can't handle it. Okay? Can't do anything about it. I doubt very seriously that anybody in here has ever walked into a dark room, found the light switch, flipped it on, and as they're flipping the switch, thought, I really hope this light is powerful enough to pierce through this darkness this time. Because it always does. Now, you might wonder if the electricity is on, if the bulbs burn out, if the switch works, things like that. But that's not the light's fault. That's mechanical failure. The light will always, always overcome the darkness. And the two don't mix. It's impossible. They can't. God is light. And in Him there is no darkness, right? In heaven, heaven is light because there's no darkness. Where's the darkness? Outside, where there's wailing and gnashing of teeth. We know this. But yet, we sometimes forget because we will occasionally try to mix our life, in our life, light and dark, good and evil. And I think God tells us over and over in the Scripture, not you shouldn't do that, but it can't be done. Because you can't serve two masters. You're going to lean toward one, or you're going to lean toward the other and end up serving one or serving the other, but you can't do both. And I think one of the signifiers that helps us know that the church we attend, or the church universal, I'll use that term, that is moving away from Christ, is that evil and good begin to be mixed a little bit. I'll pause here for any comments or thoughts.
I agree with you on the light and the darkness, but then how did we come up with, when you put the salt in the fresh water, it overcome the fresh water?
Because they can be mixed. God allows some things to be mixed. But light and dark, it seems like, is, we always say oil and water don't mix, but do they? They can. You shake them up long enough, you get them in the right circumstances, they'll mix. Other things will mix, but light and dark seems to be a substance, two things in the universe, I won't use the word substance, but two things in the universe that God has said from the very beginning, you can't mix. And then all through the Bible, what does He do? He uses light as a symbol for good and dark for a symbol for evil, and I think He's teaching us something. Well, they salute. That's right. You end up with that. A little leaven. Right. And I think that's part of it. You can't serve one or the other. You can't have both in there. Jesus used that. A spring can't bring both fresh water and bad. You can't have a fruit tree that brings forth two kinds of fruit. Although technically now you can, because you can graft them. But naturally. Okay, naturally.
I don't know what teachers would teach. I remember it. Darkness is the absence of light.
That's the scientific definition. The absence of light.
So actually, darkness is void. It's nothing.
Nothing.
With the light, we can define it.
Right.
It's definable. Now, when the light's not quite bright enough, it won't completely cover up the darkness.
But you can get to the light.
Mixed, but it's just,
that's right. You can find the light because it's there.
Yeah.
How do I find the salt when I poured it into the water? Unless I get rid of the water.
The reason that the Dead Sea is dead is because it has too much salt. It has more salt than any. Well, there's fried shrimp that can live on this upper level with a little bit of fresh water mix, but most fish can't. The water analogy is good, but it does kind of break down.
Sure.
Because we go get some water out of the tap, it's got salt in it. And what we're calling fresh water fish, they may have been varying degrees of saltiness in their water from
brackish all the way, very salty, as far as we might be concerned. Many types of fish can go back and forth, and that works fine for me. The previous example about watering down, you use the lemonade. Well, I like to have a slice of lemon in my glass of ice water when I go to a restaurant. I like that little taste, especially if maybe there's a little bit of something funky in the local water.
Covers it up a little.
But, you know, when you look at it that way, how far do you go before you say, you know, I want lemonade, and this is not lemonade. But then the other way is the sneaky thing, here what we're talking about. There are poisons that are colorless, they're odorless,
yep.
They're tasteless. You can put drops in that, and there are some of these that you can, you know, if you were so inclined, you could feed to someone over a period of time that accumulates in their body and eventually they're dead. And they didn't know what was happening to them.
Yep.
Their hair starts falling out and things start happening and then they die. Well, this is kind of the concept we're looking at. A little bit. That's not good water anymore.
Right.
A couple of drops. And you got poison.
Yep. What is it? Did somebody use the example of rat poison this meeting? I thought they did. Who did? Rick did. Rat poison. What was the percentage? I've forgotten now. 0.005 of rat poison is actual poison. The rest of it is fine.
Your point is really good because we're talking about the future of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Before the end, according to the Bible, there's not going to be very much light in the world. There's not going to be much fresh water in the world. And all we can do is make sure that we're trying to have as much light and try to keep the church as pure as we can. That's the best we can do for the future of the church.
That's right. We're going to do one more comment and then we'll move on.
It was a kind of a shock to me when I finally realized, and yet I knew this all my life, that our God is a binary person. You either do it this way or you do it that way. You either satisfy me this way or anything else is
right.
Displeasing. And if you look at all the choices God has ever given in Scripture, there is no middle ground. There is nothing in between one and two.
You're either for me or you're against me. Yep.
That's right.
Okay, let's look at the next one. Compromising of standards. I immediately think of the Corinthians that we've talked a lot about, especially this week, but over the course of this meeting. They just started compromising all over the place, didn't they? They compromised how they were going to do the Lord's Supper, or at least the manner in what they were going to do it. They started compromising on what they were going to allow to be called a brother or sister within the congregation. That could be the mixing of the evil with the good, too. These overlap. So we have to be very careful that we do not compromise the standards of God. And we have to remember that it's not my standards that are important. It's God's standards. My standards, if they're compromised, that depends. Because if my standards are God's standards, then my standards better not be compromised. But if my standards are my own feelings and thoughts and traditions and wishes, then compromising them doesn't cost anybody else their soul. If I feel it's wrong, perhaps that might bother me, be sin to me. So we have to be careful we don't compromise our standards. And the example I think of is in Galatians chapter 2, verse 11, when Paul lets us know that of an occurrence that happened at Antioch. I'm not going to ask, everybody knows this story. I'm going to remember that. Okay? Paul shows up at Antioch and he finds out that Peter had been up there for some time. And how was he treating the Gentiles at first? Just fine. They were perfectly fine. But when some Jewish brethren came up that had the mindset that seemed to be prevalent of the day that Gentiles were lesser Christians than Jewish Christians, how did Peter treat the Gentile Christians? Not as well. Showed favoritism. And it got so bad, right, that Barnabas, one of my favorite characters in the Bible, gave in, went through it. Peter compromised his own standards, and that led to other people compromising theirs. And so Paul says, I had to withstand him to his face. In fact, it even goes as far a few verses down to say he did this in front of everybody. Everybody needed to know about this. And it seems that Peter recognized it perhaps and changed. But it's interesting, or it's important, I think, for us to remember that we cannot compromise God's standards. And when they begin to be compromised, that might be an issue that's going to slowly lead us away from God, further and further away from God. Compromising them is away from God in the first place. But it might lead us further and further away, and the further away we get, sometimes the more difficult it is for us to come back.
I think the world is really, really, really trying to do that to us right now. Like
yeah.
Gay marriage and that kind of stuff.
I think that's exactly right.
Force it on us in so many ways that we'll just accept it.
Yep. I think that's exactly right. It's like Janice was saying. They believe that the more they push it, the more people think the way they do and just give in, okay, fine, whatever, just leave me alone, and then they'll have their way. And that's exactly what's happening. And so we have to be sure that we stand for what's right all the time and not compromise those standards.
I'm like you on Barnabas. Why would Barnabas go along with what Peter was doing? And I wonder if they could have justified, and even Peter, I don't think Peter was trying to be mean. I think they could have justified it with expediency, thinking that if we are going to offend our Jewish brethren, it's better not to do this while we're here.
Yeah.
And Paul had to show that that's not something you do. This is one of those cases where if it offends somebody, then you have to, that's the way it has to be because you're doing the right thing. If it's something that doesn't matter, then you back away from it. But this is something that matters. You need to keep this relationship with the Gentile brethren, and they need to learn that too.
Right. And that goes back to deciding whether what's being compromised is my standard or God's, and making sure that I'm most concerned with God's.
Just for the sake of clarity, I can understand what we've been talking about today, right? This is a modern example of this. Could you give us what you think is a modern example of mixing good and evil?
The question is, what would be a modern example of mixing good and evil? And my Rolodex is flying right now.
Well, you can tell me later. Compromising because it's a family member, perhaps?
Perhaps. Yeah, compromising. That's a hard word. Because, again, that depends. Because that's compromising.
Would it be something like taking an activity that normally could be considered good, but doing something with that would not be... Like maybe a certain television show might be okay, but you flip over to the other channel and it's not so good, but because you've accepted one thing... I
would have to think that through to come up with a really good example. And my brain is ahead already on something else I really want to get to, and I'm having trouble backtracking. Well, I don't want to ignore you, but if anybody has a really good example right now, I'd go for that. But I'll accept your baptism even though it doesn't agree with mine. That could be. That may be more compromising. I don't know. But
one of the great examples in church history is bringing paganism into the church.
Okay, that's a really good example.
Bringing evil things in and changing the names around. And that way people didn't have to give up evil. And it was a way to get people in the church.
Thank you. That would be an excellent example. We are going to go ahead and move on because I want to get this last one and I want to get to the last point that I have. Rejection of righteousness. when right behavior, good behavior in the sight of God, doing the right thing, begins to get rejected as not necessary or unimportant or old-fashioned or whatever reason it is that it's rejected or objected to, that can be a sign. Philippians 3:9. Be found in Him not having my own righteousness, which is from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which is from God by faith. Making sure that what I think is the right behavior is not because I think it's the right behavior, but because I can see from God's Word that that's the right behavior. 1 John chapter 3, verse 7. Little children, let no one deceive you. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. I can't be righteous unless I am practicing righteousness. That's one of those can't happen. And then down just a few verses in verse 10, in this the children of God and the children of devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. I'll refer you again back to Aaron's devotional several days ago. We're either for him or against him. And this is another one of those cases. I'm either doing the right thing and behaving my way in a way that is righteous in God's sight, or I'm not. And if we begin to reject righteousness in some way or form, it doesn't matter the reason, but if we begin to reject that, then we are rejecting the standards of God. Now, I want to get to this last point because I want to take you to Matthew chapter 23. And I'm going to turn there. I'm sorry? Well, it should be 23. Yeah, it should be 23. Typo. Matthew 23 is where it should be. Ignore the slide. For those of you looking at my slides on the internet, I hope you're listening too. The slide that says example of Israel should say Matthew 23. Thank you. Hopefully that will be changed. I can't trust that technology. It's either good or evil, right? I can't sit on that class, but that's what I hear. Okay. I'm not going to read through this whole thing right now because we're going to read through it in spots. And it's not going to necessarily be in order in the Scriptures because I'm going to do it in the order I put it in the outline, not necessarily in the order I put it in the, it's in the Scriptures. I think you'll understand in a second. But I think right here, from verse 13 down, clear through verse 36, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, the leadership of the Jews, and He's telling them all the things they've done wrong, or at least a lot of them. The problems they've created within the religious nation of Israel. And I think we can see how they fit into these categories, which is one of the reasons I chose these categories. So, in verse 13, I think we see apathy. Tell me what you think. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. To me, I look at that and I see a little bit of apathy against worship. They're not interested in true worship. They're interested in the appearance of the worship. Verse 14. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore, you will receive the greater condemnation. It's all for show. It's all for show. There's apathy in what they're doing and why. And verse 15, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel the land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you yourselves. Apathy toward new converts, in this case to Judaism. But let's get them in, and then, you know, really who cares about what happens later? Let's just get them in. I think we see apathy in those verses. Watering down God's commands. We're going to skip down to verse 23. We'll come back to the others in a minute. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. They were watering down what God had said by actually making it more restrictive than God had intended. Okay? Altering those commands, changing those commands to where they're of no effect. Verse 27, I think we can begin to see some mixing of evil. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear outward, beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanliness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. They were looking like one existence on the outside, but inside they were something completely different. Mixing. Let's go back up to verse 16 now. Woe to you blind guides who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and him who sits on it. They were losing sight of what was really important. They decided some things were more important than others. And Jesus is saying, you've actually got it a little backwards. And it all should be equal important anyway. And down in verse 26, blind Pharisees, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish that the outside may be clean also. They were interested in keeping up appearances, and that compromised some of their standards, I think. All these can be two or three different things, I think, too, some of them anyway. And then in verse 29, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. And you can go ahead and read that on your own later, so we don't run completely out of time. But what he is pointing out is their forefathers, and them eventually too, because this is sort of a precursor to them of what they're going to do in killing Christ, that when somebody came to them preaching righteousness and trying to get them to change the way they were living their life, they rejected it and killed them. I think right in here, in this passage, we can see some components of what occurs when God's people begin to leave Him and turn away. And it's a warning to us. It's a warning to us to make sure that we don't have apathy. We don't water down God's commands. We don't mix the evil with the good in our life. We don't compromise God's standards, and we don't reject the righteousness of God. We hold on to that. And my topic is the future of the church. And I guess, as I kind of summarize, I can't imagine that our congregations, God will always have His church somewhere all the time until the end of time, as we know it. But if our individual congregations are going to survive the test of time, we have to make sure that we pay attention to these. Because if we don't have these, what good is it if we go convict the non-believer? If we don't have these, what good is it that we're bringing up people of the next generation to a system of godliness that is not God's? It doesn't make, we're not accomplishing anything. So, we have to protect the next generation. We have to teach the babe, keep the weak, and restore the fallen. We have to convict the non-believer, and we cannot allow the church to turn away from him. In my mind, those are four things we need to keep in mind when we talk about what is going to happen with the future of the church. And I saved this till the last. It doesn't matter what's going on outside. It doesn't matter what worldly people are doing. doesn't matter what persecution may or may not come against us. It doesn't matter what laws the country may pass that make it more difficult. None of that matters. Because in the end, all I can do is work out my own salvation with fear and trembling. All I can do is try to help my brothers and sisters stay on the right path with me. All I can do is try to reach out to those that are lost and try to bring them in so they can enjoy that same path with us. That's all I can do. God doesn't ask us to change society. He asks us to change ourselves and influence those around us. I really appreciate the brethren here allowing me to teach. I've learned a whole lot. Any of you that are taught know that that's true. And I look forward to our future as a church, whatever the Lord allows us time-wise. And I pray that we can maintain His standards and His truth in that. Thank you.